I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Delaware experienced a true blue wave in November with 12 new Democrats in the General Assembly, making the legislative body more racially diverse and more female. Democrats also hold all the statewide elected offices from governor to insurance commissioner, something the Republicans had back in 50 years ago. The new session gets underway in Dover next week, and we asked Mark Eichmann to tell us what's on the agenda. He's the deputy managing editor of WHYY's Delaware Newsroom. And Mark Eichmann, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
So how did the Democrats make so much inroads or so many inroads and win so many races?
Well, Delaware's always been a blue state for a lot of years now, and their advantage in the voter registration numbers is fairly significant. They represent 47% of registered voters are Democrat, compared to only 20% which are Republican. So those numbers already kind of bake in an advantage for Democratic candidates. Add on top of that the blue wave or the reaction to the Trump administration in the midterm election. And you saw what we got in November with Democrats sweeping Republicans out of statewide office. As you mentioned, the first time that's happened in decades and decades, the first time the Democrats have ever pulled that off to hold, the state's congressional delegation, the governor's office, and all those state row offices. So it's really a Democratic year, and we'll see what they do to it. They also added to their advantage. They already held an advantage in the Senate and the House, and they added a seat to each of those. So now they're up in the state House by a significant margin, and up in the Senate by just a 12-9 advantage over Republicans. So the only area the Republicans are even close is in the state Senate. The Democrats are up 26-15 in the state House.
So is it lonely to be a Republican in Delaware?
It certainly is getting more and more that way. And we saw a number of really high-profile Republicans, kind of the bench that was going to be maybe challenging Governor John Carney in 2020 for the governor's office, knocked out of office, including State Senator Greg Lavelle, who was really a leader for Republicans and holding the GOP flag in the state Senate, and also Ken Simpler, who was Delaware's treasurer. He was a first-termer, but was really somebody that people had been hinting around and speculating that he may run for governor in 2020, and he was knocked out of office by a Democratic woman. And so now it's kind of, where are the Republicans' leaders going to come from? Who's going to challenge for the governor's office in 2020? Kind of an open question.
You talked about 47% of Delaware residents are Democrats, 20% Republicans. That leaves about 33%. What are they?
So independents.
Okay.
So that's the big swing. And then in a year when you have, kind of this blue wave idea, kind of nationally, you see that playing out locally. A lot of those independents who had traditionally in Delaware been kind of ticket splitters and gone either way, leaning more towards the D's this time around.
I did a little Google search. So you had to go back to 1969 when Republicans had all those statewide races, and today now they're held all by Democrats.
Right, and all those races, all those seats, auditor, treasurer, attorney general, have not historically all been elected. So back in the 60s was one of the first times that was even possible, and the Republicans only held it, I believe, for just 2 years before it split and became more diverse between Republicans and Democrats. And so it's been a long time coming, and I'm not 100% sure what the impact of that will be on the state, but it's something we'll continue to watch.
The new session gets underway in Dover next week. January 8th, do I have the correct date there?
Tuesday,
whatever Tuesday is.
That is the 8th, yep, you're right.
Back in session. So what's on the docket? What's on the agenda?
Well, there's a lot of stuff kind of left over from last session. So everything restarts, and none of the bills that were voted on last year and waiting action in the other House are up for any. They're all wiped out. So it's kind of starting with a clean slate, but some ideas that are left over from last year include recreational marijuana, which has been pushed for a number of years here in Delaware. The state approved medical marijuana back in 2011, and the first dispensaries opened for that in 2015. And for the last 2 years, there's been kind of an ongoing debate about legislation that would legalize recreational marijuana. We got as close as the state has been in June when the state house defeated the bill 21-15, and that had five Democrats abstaining from the vote. So it's close. It was close last year, as close as it's been. And the year before that, in 2017, the bill didn't get out of a House committee. Was voted out of a House committee, but didn't get voted on the full floor. And then in true Delaware fashion, they created a task force to study the issue, which is what we'd like to do, which is what we like to do with controversial things, take a task force. And so the supporters and opponents were both put on this adult use cannabis task force, is what it was called, to kind of hash out their differences. They came out with a report last year that was supposed to make everybody happy and kind of made really nobody happy, and that's why we got the result of the 21-15 vote against recreational marijuana. And the two legislators that were the main supporters of that and the sponsors of that bill, State Rep. Helene Keeley and Senator Margaret Rose Henry, both decided not to run for re-election in November. And so that leaves it for somebody else to pick up that mantle of the recreational marijuana push, which will likely happen, but it's just not clear who will lead that charge. And should point out that the governor, John Carney, has come out repeatedly against recreational marijuana, saying he doesn't think Delaware ought to be a leader on that issue. And so it's doubtful whether he would sign legislation, even if it were approved. But that's definitely something that we'll be looking at this session.
What's so interesting, we're going to be talking about New Jersey and then also Pennsylvania, what's happening in the state houses there. And all these states are struggling with what to do or where to stand when it comes to recreational marijuana. Mark, let me go back. The ERA, which I certainly remember from my youth, making its way through the legislature in Delaware. What's the status there?
So it was brought up, I believe, in May for a vote and was defeated, and then came back with some amendments, and it was approved in June. So that's the first leg of the amendment to the Delaware's Constitution. And so that has to be approved by back-to-back General Assemblies. And so now that we're in this new session with new lawmakers after the midterm, that will be back up for discussion over the next 2 years. And it has to be done before the end of the session in 2020, and it will become a part of the state constitution officially. And so supporters, for those not familiar with Equal Rights Amendment, supporters say it's needed to ensure that gender issues continue to be addressed as they evolve, and specifically puts that language into the state constitution and is designed to prevent the passage of discriminatory laws, whatever they may be, whatever the issue may come up in the years to come.
We talked about recreational marijuana, the ERA. What about things like healthcare, education, environment, the kind of sort of bread and butter issues that often state legislators have to deal with? Are they on the docket?
They certainly will, and healthcare specifically, especially when it comes to the state budget portion of healthcare and what the state pays for healthcare. Governor Carney has, late last year, approved a measure, an executive order that would put a cap on healthcare spending growth within the state budget, and would hook that cap to growth in state revenue. And so for this year, the first year they're going to try to do this will be 3.5% growth is what they will try to cap what the state spends on healthcare. And so whether that goal can be hit and that limit can be kept under remains to be seen. And another part of that is going to be trying to encourage hospitals, doctors, and medical providers to limit their spending or their expenses. So it's kind of an interesting approach and something that we'll have to see how it actually plays out.
Is there a surplus in Delaware?
There is a slight surplus. The governor hasn't put his budget out for the 2020 fiscal year, which starts in June. He'll do that later this month, and that's when we'll get a real picture, a real look at where the state budget is. Budget growth for revenue is expected to be about 2% right now. That was the numbers from December. So that's probably less than what the budget will actually grow. I think we grew about 3.5%, 4% in the last year. So if it grows about the same amount, we will have some revenue to make up. But the additional revenue could also be found between now and June 30th. So we'll see.
Mark, you were a co-host of a WHYY documentary, Delaware's Joe Biden, of course, was vice president, longtime senator. What is the support for Biden in Delaware now?
Probably as strong as it's ever been. I think while we were producing that documentary on Biden's time and path from Delaware senator to the vice presidency, we talked to a lot of people, and just about anybody we talked to, as we were trying to talk to him, to people just about what Biden means to them or his time in Delaware, almost everybody we asked said that they would support him and he should run for president. Whether we asked them about the presidency or a potential run or not, they volunteered. He should run for president.
Oh, interesting.
So it was, probably 90% of the people I talked to volunteered that by themselves. So I'd say it's very strong for support for a potential Biden 2020.
Is that because he's from Delaware and Delaware's a small state and everybody knows everybody in Delaware?
Yeah, that probably plays a big role in that. I think it goes back to that to those numbers also on the voter registration, right? So there's a lot of Democrats here and a lot of Democrats like Joe Biden here. But it also is another thing people told me. Everybody had sort of I met Joe Biden when we were at the Home Depot or, we were at the mall and I ran into him and he took a picture with me and he was super nice. So almost everybody I talked to had one of those stories too. So there's sort of that retail politics that people feel like they really know him from being here because it is such a small state. And he's been around here in Delaware forever. You know, going back to the 70s, he's been a name in Delaware. So a lot of people know him. A lot of people like him here. And I think he would get a lot of support for a presidential run here, whether he decides to do it or not.
Mark,
is another thing.
About 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye to you, did I forget anything? Anything we left out?
The one thing that we'll also look for is gun legislation. The state had a number of gun bills that did get approved, including a ban on bump stocks, trigger cranks, and this red flag legislation that allows a lethal violence protection order to take guns temporarily from somebody who's deemed a threat. The one thing that didn't get done last year was a ban on certain types of assault-style weapons, so we'll see if that comes back up this year.
Fair enough. Mark Eichmann, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Happy to be with you. Thanks.
You're welcome. And he's the deputy managing editor of WHYY's Delaware Newsroom. We are checking in with Delaware coming up next, New Jersey, and then Pennsylvania. What's on tap when it comes to the state legislatures? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Artie Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy is finishing up his first year on the job, and it's clear he is not his predecessor, Chris Christie, both politically speaking and by personality. The former Goldman Sachs executive has had some legislative successes, some no-goes, and it's clear he's still learning how to deal with the Democrats who control Trenton. Some of the key issues are the millionaire's tax, legalizing recreational marijuana, raising the minimum wage, and the perennial thorn in homeowners' sides, property taxes. Well, here to fill us in is Joe Hernandez, New Jersey State Governor, government reporter for WHYY and for WBGO. Joe, nice to have you back with us on
Thanks,
Radio
Marty.
Times. And joining us by telephone, Patrick Murray. He's director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute. Patrick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Same here, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And for the next 20 minutes, we will be talking about New Jersey. So, Joe, let me begin with you. I mentioned Governor Murphy in my introduction. How would you say he did his first year on the job?
I think he would probably say he did well, but there's more work to do if I had to guess what he would say. He's had some major priorities that haven't gotten anywhere, in part because he's struggled to work with top Democrats in the legislature to get them done. So minimum wage, recreational marijuana. We had redistricting as well. But on the other hand, he would say, you know, they've made moves to make community colleges more affordable. He's done a lot of work on NJ Transit. The agency did a big audit recently, and so he says there's progress being made there. They put in positive train control, which was not a sure thing by the end of the year, and this is federally mandated. So I think he would say, you know, or at least many residents might say, mixed success. He's done some things, but he hasn't been able to achieve some others.
And just to underscore the fact that the fight in New Jersey is between a Democratic governor and the Democrats who control Trenton.
Right. This is not political partisanship. This is kind of where you are in the state and what kind of Democrat you are in New Jersey. Murphy is a Democrat, and the state legislature is also controlled by Democrats.
Phil, Patrick, let me go to you. How do New Jerseyans feel about their new governor?
Yeah, he's been getting pretty good reviews, according to all the polls that have been taken, positive job approval rating. I think in most part it's because of the contrast, as you mentioned at the top of this piece, with Chris Christie, is that, you know, they have a governor now that they don't see in their face every day. And for a lot of New Jerseyans, that in and of itself is a good thing. You know, they understand, you know, he has a lot of liberal policies. They're not sure exactly what's going to happen with them. As Joe mentioned, some of his big ticket items like minimum wage, legal recreational marijuana still are sitting on the table yet. So it remains to be seen, you know, how much further he can get down the road. But as of right now, his numbers are pretty good.
Is the debate among Democrats, Joe, in New Jersey about policy, about politics, about personality? I'm thinking of all the P's that I can throw out there.
I think you probably hit all the P's there. I mean, there are certainly personality issues and, you know, politics that play a role into why some of these things haven't gotten through. You know, Phil Murphy is aligned with some of the more central North Jersey elements of New Jersey politics, whereas the state Senate president, Steve Sweeney, is from down here in Gloucester County. So in some ways, they've, you know, butted heads on certain policy issues, but also on the details of certain policy issues. And if Sweeney doesn't put up a bill, then Murphy doesn't get to sign the bill. So it's partly that, and partly, you know, as we talk about some of these issues, we could talk about the specifics. But, you know, for example, on minimum wage, there's disagreements over how quickly that minimum wage should be phased in and who should get the minimum wage when it is phased in.
Do you want to add to that, Patrick Murray?
Yeah, I think... really, it's going to be a big lift for him. It really is the personality thing. I think that's the P that I would focus on the most here. It's, you know, he has not had experience in state government, doesn't understand how that works. And whether it's Trenton or Albany or Harrisburg or, you know, anywhere else, there is a norm of behavior that legislative leaders, administrative leaders expect. And he's still, I think, kind of feeling his way around there.
Are we talking deference?
I don't even think it's deference. I think it's just understanding. I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of deference. You know, there's a legislative leadership and so forth. But I think there's just an understanding that a lot of this just gets done because you can sit down across the table from somebody. And what Governor Murphy has been doing a lot of since the beginning of his administration is having a lot of press conferences and having a lot of announcements of what his policies are before sitting down and hammering out the deal with the legislative leadership. So he's putting them on their back heels, you know, saying, you know, I didn't want this done, and it might be the first that they've actually heard of it.
Joe, you're nodding your head.
And there's been a lot of reporting about how little the sides have met over the past few months. Murphy and the state senate president, Steve Sweeney, have not met very often. And what we have seen, as Patrick has mentioned, are these press conferences saying, we need to do minimum wage, we need to do minimum wage, and then Steve Sweeney responding, the way to do that is not through press conferences, you know, insulting me or anything like that. So personality is probably a big one to focus on.
There's a question from Rochelle, and Joel, I'll put it back to you. Have Murphy's ratings been hurt at all by the Katie Brennan case? She was a volunteer for the Murphy campaign. She filed a sexual assault charge against a staffer, a guy named Al Alvarez. This is a complicated case, but can you fill us in?
I can recap it, but Patrick is probably best suited on the ratings question.
Sure.
Katie Brennan was a former volunteer for the Murphy campaign and then worked in the Murphy transition and now works in Murphy's administration in the Housing and Mortgage Finance Agency. And she alleges that this guy, Al Alvarez, raped her in her apartment during the campaign, that she told the police, but the prosecutor declined to press charges, that she told transition officials and later administration officials. And she says all along the way, her pleas were ignored. Finally, she told the Wall Street Journal her story. That's when it blew up. And currently, we are going through hearings in the state legislature investigating why Brennan's claims weren't addressed by transition or administration officials and why Alvarez was able to get a job in the campaign and in the transition and also in the administration.
And apparently he was chief of staff of New Jersey Schools Development Authority, able to keep that job for, what, something like 6 months, right?
For 6 months, yes, and in, until October when the Wall Street Journal reached out to him for a comment.
Yep. Interesting. And we should say that Alvarez was never charged, as you said, Joe, and he denies the allegation.
Right.
But Patrick, let me get you in on the conversation. How are New Jersey voters feeling about this?
This is not clear. I think until we had the hearing, the legislative hearing in December, that was the one where the administration officials showed up and started talking about what they knew, and we learned some information that they actually knew this, who the accuser was a few months before we even had heard before. But the point being is that it's still not all that well known to New Jerseyans. They're not following this story closely. Most of the poll ratings that we have for the governor are from before this news has really hit, and I think we're going to see a lot more of it in the coming year. And that's where I think that the numbers will come up when we have some of these people who have not appeared before the committee are scheduled to testify next week. And so I think that could change this dynamic a little bit.
And that is Patrick Murray. He's director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute. Joining us along with Joe Hernandez, he is New Jersey State Government reporter for WHYY and for WBGO, and spending this portion of Radio Times talking about what is happening in New Jersey related to policies and politics and politicians and personalities. Let me get Georgina from Ocean City, New Jersey, to join us. Georgina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Overall, I think Governor Murphy is doing a good job, but the environmental community is very disappointed in him. He has not taken a stand against the Southern Reliability Link New Jersey Natural Gas Pipeline that has begun being built in Plumstead, New Jersey, in spite of legal challenges by Sierra Club and Pinelands Preservation Alliance. He's also allowed the DEP to continue as exactly the same way that the Christie administration has them, and also the Pinelands Commission. We're very, very concerned about the South Jersey Gas Pipeline going through the Pinelands, and also that Murphy has not changed the executive director of the Pinelands Commission or reappointed new members to the Pinelands Commission.
I appreciate the call, and you raised several important points. I mean, just because you're sitting across from me, Joe, anything you want to add or say in response?
So the Southern Reliability Link pipeline is starting to be built. This was started, I think, a few weeks ago, and this was long fought by environmental groups in South Jersey. On the flip side, I would point to maybe some things that the Attorney General, Grabir Graywall, has done on environmental issues. There were recently rulings allowing the Penn East Pipeline Company to take some property by eminent domain, and the administration is fighting that. Just recently, the administration has also filed lawsuits, some environmental justice lawsuits, they're calling them, to clean up contaminated sites in poor and minority neighborhoods across the state. And they're also fighting back against the Trump administration and their plan to open up offshore drilling off the Atlantic coast. So maybe a mixed bag in some ways from an environmental standpoint.
Georgina, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's an email from Cassandra. She says, I'm 28, thinking about purchasing my first home, and New Jersey has property taxes that are absolutely too high to manage, especially for a social worker like me. It's hard to buy a home, and my salary is $32,000 a year with a college degree. And she goes on from there. Patrick Murray, this has been a perennial complaint in New Jersey, the high property taxes. Is there any movement on that? Is there any direction up or down when it comes to property taxes?
This is one of the most amazing things, I think, of this administration, the last administration, past administration, is that every time we poll and we ask New Jerseyans what the number one issue in the state is, it always comes up as property taxes. This is the thing that they look at and they see as kind of the meme for the cost of living in New Jersey and the problems of New Jersey. And, Governor Christie did not tackle this problem, and he never really said he would. Phil Murphy has, from day one, has said this really is not a big problem. And he kind of doesn't understand how that's ingrained in the fabric of the New Jersey public.
Is that because he doesn't make $32,000 a year?
He pays $32,000 a year in property taxes. I think that's why he doesn't think about that in that way. So I think that's one of the areas where there's just a real disconnect with him. And this is one of the things that Steve Sweeney is trying to put him in a corner on. Pension reform and property taxes are the issues that are really differentiating Sweeney. You know, we've talked about personality, but I think if we're talking about the difference of issues between the Senate president and the governor, it's property taxes and pension reform.
Let me put something else on the table, something, Joe, you've written about having to do with redistricting. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to quote here a plan by New Jersey Democrats to reimagine the process of redrawing state legislative district lines is facing a growing outcry from good government groups, progressives, nonpartisan voting experts, Republicans, and even some fellow Democrats. What's going on?
It failed. So that iteration of the plan was scrapped after just basically everybody and their mother opposed this thing except some top Democrats in the legislature who proposed it. There were two main parts of it. The most significant, Patrick has done a lot of work on this too and could speak to it. But the most significant, I think, was the way that they were going to redraw the districts in a way that kind of would entrench the power of Democrats for years to come. They were also planning to reshuffle how people got onto the commission that made these decisions in a way that would kind of shift the power balance away from Murphy a little bit. And that was a bit more of an insidery potential power grab. But ultimately, none of this happened and in December. But the issue isn't going away. So they're going to have to figure out how to move forward on this and go ahead. And the window for making it a constitutional amendment, I think, maybe is closing. Patrick could speak to that. But so they might need to actually find some consensus on this, which there was not at all in December.
Because redistricting happens every 10 years and there's a certain timetable. Patrick, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I've been talking with the legislative sponsors of this bill. One of the things that's really fascinating is that they didn't think that their fellow Democrats would come out against this. This was a Democrat-sponsored bill. They thought that this gerrymander formula that they were put in was just a fair formula that represented the Democratic leanings of the state, and they found out that their own groups, particularly those who really fought this for this blue wave in 2018, said this is not why we got involved in politics. This is not why we elected the new folks that we elected into Congress, is that we want fair elections. We don't need to win by rigging the system. So that was one part of it. But there's still the potential for movement here. They really do still want to do something. So the League of Women Voters, a number of academic organizations, including my own, are going to be meeting over the next few months to put a proposal to get public input, because that was really what happened. This deal was designed behind closed doors, and I think we all acknowledge that we need to look at redistricting in New Jersey. It can be improved, but it needs to be improved with public input. So we're now that the Pandora's box has been opened, we want to make sure that it's done right.
What about legalized sports gambling? New Jersey, Joe, was the first state to legalize it. So what's the status on that? And obviously there's more competition as more states get in on the act.
Right, including Delaware. I mean, I think maybe about half a dozen states now have legalized, kind of regulated sports betting since that U.S. Supreme Court decision over the summer. And Jersey's been doing it since then. If I'm remembering my numbers correctly, about under $1 billion in revenue in New Jersey, but just I think around 8 or so or 10 million in tax revenue for the state. So it's going along.
That's pretty small, isn't it? Out of almost $1 billion.
Yeah.
You're
well,
right.
I'll have to check my numbers, but I think yeah. I mean, it is not going to be the windfall that some people were hoping for as far as tax revenue goes. But you know, it is functioning. It's going along in New Jersey, and they're also, you know, the horse racing industry that thought that this was going to be a panacea for them is also struggling because it's not.
Oh, interesting. About a minute before we have to say goodbye, Patrick Murray. This is a theme that's going to run through the show today, having to do with recreational marijuana. What's the status in New Jersey?
The governor wants it. Some of the legislative leadership wants it, but there are some key Democrats, including some who are aligned with the governor, who are worried about it, particularly urban Democrats, who are worried that this could actually lead to a lower quality of life in their own neighborhoods if they become the source areas for legal marijuana.
So does that mean it's still in flux, or people are having meetings about this? Where do you think this will go?
It's still in flux. I mean, there are still some players that have to come to the table to agree with this, and it's not along the typical fault lines that we've been talking about between Steve Sweeney and Phil Murphy at this point.
Well, on that note, we're going to leave it there. Patrick Murray, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute, which is in New Jersey. Joe Hernandez, as always, thanks for coming in and talking about New Jersey.
You got it.
And he is New Jersey State Government reporter for WHYY and for WBGO. Well, we've got one more state we're going to talk about, Pennsylvania, coming up next after this very short break with Katie Meyer and John Baer. Stay with us. Much more to discuss after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. State lawmakers in Harrisburg took the oath of office on New Year's Day this week, including former Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. Democrats picked up 5 seats in the Senate and 11 in the House in November and still remain the minority party. Governor Tom Wolf, known for his mild-mannered personality, easily won a second term, beating Scott Wagner, who at one point in the campaign threatened to stomp all over Wolf's face with golf spikes, and that's a quote. We're going to round out today's show with a look at the people, the politics, and policies of the Pennsylvania government. And joining us by telephone, Katie Meyer, State Capitol Bureau Chief for WITF, who reports for WHYY. Katie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, John Baer, and he's a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Philadelphia Daily News. And John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everybody here and to our listeners. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Katie, let me go to you. Let's go back a couple of days ago. How many new members of the Pennsylvania legislature?
So all told, in the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats, there are 50 new members. So that's one of the biggest crops of new faces we've seen in quite some time.
And why do you think that is?
Well, these things sort of come in waves. I think this was a big year specifically for Democrats. They saw, I think a majority of the new members. And, you saw a big influx of votes for Democrats and just, interest in the election. And also, a lot of people retired. That was the other thing. And it's kind of, that goes beyond any political trends. But we saw a lot of longtime lawmakers stepping down, some, at the top of their parties.
John, if I'm a freshman Democrat, what leverage do I have in Harrisburg?
None.
None? Ouch.
No, stay home.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, sad but true. I mean, so much has changed, and yet so much will remain the same. Republicans, despite the gains by Democrats, still hold very healthy majorities in both chambers, and the majority rules. So if you're a Democrat, especially a freshman Democrat, what you can do is find a mentor, figure out how things work, come up with a piece of legislation that somebody who knows something will work with you on in an issue you care about, and ease yourself into the game. Otherwise, you make a lot of noise, maybe. You hold a press conference. You put out press releases. But actually getting something done is very unlikely.
Is there bipartisanship, John, in Harrisburg?
Please. Marty, you know as well as I do.
I'm just checking. Go ahead, John.
I'll let you know if that ever changes, but Pennsylvania remains one of the most partisan states in America in terms of its legislature because the divide is so great, and we've talked about this before. Sure. You have literally two or three different cultural parts of Pennsylvania, and they clash, and the representatives from each try to represent each, and it's very difficult to get a consensus on major issues or issues that affect everybody in the state.
Katie, you had a piece about the committee chairs. This gets into the weeds, but I think it's important for people, especially if you live in Pennsylvania, to understand how bills make it to the floor. Help us understand what's going on or what is happening as related to these committee chairs.
Sure. So I think it's important to preface. I mean, committee chairs do have, you know, inordinate power in Pennsylvania's legislature. These are the people who decide when a bill is introduced whether or not it gets debated in a committee. And if it can get debated in a committee and passes the committee, it can be considered on the floor and maybe become a law. But, you know, if it doesn't get a debate, if it just gets held up and, you know, ignored in that committee, it's never going to go anywhere. And so these chairs are all Republicans. They are the ones who set the calendars for these committees because they're in the majority. And you have had some committee chairs over the last, you know, several years who have sort of made a point of not bringing up Democratic legislation. In particular, there was a committee chair named Daryl Metcalf.
Right.
He still is a chair. But he chaired the House State Government Committee, and, you know, there were bills on redistricting that he, you know, gutted all of the language Democrats put in there and replaced it with his own stuff. There was a law adding protections for LGBTQ people that he didn't want to bring up for a debate, and so it languished in there for years. So, you know, you see people with a lot of power in these committees.
Let me read a couple of comments, and we'll get Rick from Richboro to join us. A tweet from Nathaniel. Issues I'd like to see my state legislature address: gun control, real money for transit, climate leadership. Facebook comment from Eileen. A new map for voting districts, which is reasonable and fair. Is this possible in our country today? And let me get Rick from Richboro to weigh in on that as well. Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to ask what the prospects were for HB 722 and S-22 for the redistricting in the original format. It seems that the committee chairs, as you just mentioned, have pretty much effectively held these up.
John, can you weigh in on this? And we should just add that that the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania basically drew the boundaries for the congressional map. Where do things stand in Pennsylvania related to gerrymandering or redistricting?
They pretty much stand where they stood before that happened, and the key here, Marty, as I'm sure you know, is that the redraw of the congressional maps is a one-time thing. In other words, after the next census, the process of getting the congressional maps still belongs to the legislature. So those districts could change. They could revert back to what they were, or they could substantially change in any other way. The legislative redistricting, reapportionment it's called, remains in control of the legislature. Mm-hmm. There is very little interest in the part of Republican legislative leaders to change that. And so I think the redistricting issue faces the same challenges it faced last year as we move into the new year, which is pretty slim, pretty grim.
Well, Katie, you want to weigh in on this, and you have talked to, as have I, I'm sure John is as well, from Fair District, Pennsylvania. Mm. There are grassroots efforts to try to change all this. Do they have the clout, I guess, to do that?
Well, you know, I don't think necessarily. I mean, we saw last year where these bills, again, just kind of languished in committees, didn't get a lot of purchase. You know, there were lots of debates. The Senate passed a version of a redistricting bill, but you couldn't see any real agreement between the caucuses about it. I should note there is one specific change. I had mentioned Daryl Metcalf, who chaired the House State Government Committee. You know, the committees were all moved around, and now he's on a different committee, and his replacement, a guy named Garth Everett from Lycoming County, I don't think he's quite as fiery. So, you know, I'm not sure where he's going to stand on that or if it's going to change how the House approaches the issue. But that's something to watch. But no, I think John's absolutely right. This is an issue that there's not a lot of interest because, again, this involves the legislature basically decreasing its own power, and it's rare that they'll do that.
Well, it's interesting when we put on Facebook yesterday, you know, what do you want your legislature to do? And gerrymandering or redistricting was really on the top of the list. Here's an email from Beverly. The lawsuit that led to redistricting for the U.S. House of Representatives seats led to more Democrats from PA to D.C. Why has there been no lawsuit to redistrict the gerrymandered districts for the Pennsylvania General Assembly? John, can you weigh in on that?
Well, I mean, in part, Marty, it's because the congressional districts were obviously awful. I mean, they were among the worst gerrymandered in the United States. The legislative districts are not that bad. I mean, there are selective. You can find some seats that are ridiculous. But basically, I mean, that's where people live in Pennsylvania. I mean, the vast majority of the state is rural and suburban. And so when you start to carve that up, that's where the representation comes from. So they're not as bad. The process of how they get there is on paper not horrible. Both sides have say. I mean, the majority. I mean, the reason we have elections is to decide which party is going to be in the majority. All right. So we have elections statewide for legislative districts, and so the people that win that get to have a little bit of an edge when it comes to reapportionment. So it's not a terrible system. Could it be better? Absolutely, it could be better. But it really depends who's in charge and who's running the shop and how much abuse takes place. So the basic answer and the short-form answer is because the state reapportionment stuff is not as horrible as the congressional stuff was.
Fair enough. A question from David who says, I'm an abuse survivor. I was abused by a Catholic priest as a child. I know a bill to open up the statute of limitations around abuse that happened in the Catholic Church passed in the House, but it's being blocked by Pennsylvania State Senator Joe Scarnati. Are there any plans with the new legislature to push it forward for survivors to get justice so we can hold those who let this happen responsible? And of course, this is related to some degree to the Attorney General and his expose last summer. Katie, can you weigh in on that?
Sure. So we saw the legislature, you know, give it a really good effort to pass this legislation last session, and they were not able to. And you're right, the key provision of this, the part that was controversial and ultimately sank the negotiations, was this thing that would have allowed lawsuits on old cases. The reason why it's controversial is the Catholic Church, you know, vehemently opposes it. They argued that it would bankrupt churches. And, you know, whether or not that would actually happen or if that would actually hurt the churches because they've gone bankrupt in other states and been fine, you know, that's up for debate. But, you know, Joe Scarnati, the Senate President Pro Tem, was sort of the leading voice against it, and his caucus was not able to come to an agreement. So this is going to come up this session again. There's a lot of support for this change in the House. There's also a lot of support for the change in the Senate. But, you know, Scarnati's still there. The leadership that opposed it before is still in place, and it doesn't seem like they've changed their stance very much. I do think there have been talks going on between the two sides, and, you know, some people have been pretty optimistic that they'll get somewhere with it. So we're going to have to see where it goes.
John, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a heavy lift. It was a heavy lift last year. The pressure has been off for a little bit. Katie is right. It will come back. Shapiro certainly isn't going to let it go. The governor supports it. There are advocates and victims who obviously are very interested in making the change. Mm-hmm. But Scarnati and other people in the leadership seem pretty firm in their position. So I think that what will happen is it will come up, it will get pushed around a little bit, and then we'll get into the budget season and everybody's attention will turn toward money.
Well, and I do want to get to the budget, but John, you mentioned Governor Wolf, and he did win 58% of the votes, a pretty sizable win. What kind of mandate does he have?
Well, you know, that's always a great question, and whether he has a mandate or not, I mean, the Republicans will say, well, look, we retained majorities in both of our chambers, so we have a mandate, too. Mm-hmm. So let's put our mandates together and see which one's bigger. and that is the eternal fight when you have split government. So, and the governor, as you know, has a litany of things that he would like to do, including ethical reform and voting reform and a severance tax and a minimum wage increase. But those are things that this legislature consistently has opposed, and I see no reason why they would suddenly support it for a governor who can't run for reelection again.
Because they don't see him as scary enough or just have enough clout?
Because they have the votes. I mean, they have their positions and their ideologies, and they have the votes.
John mentioned the budget, and Katie Meyer, is it going to be kind of a deja vu all over again when it comes to the budget in Pennsylvania?
Oh, well, we'll see. You have a lot of, you know, everybody basically in the legislature putting a real happy face on this. Our revenues have been coming in pretty strongly this year, and they're a little bit above where they were projected to be at this point, which is good news. The Independent Fiscal Office has projected we're going to have a really big deficit to contend with. They said around $1.5 billion. The governor, the legislature on both sides, they all say that's they need to be, they're way more optimistic about it, although they haven't put out their own numbers yet. So really it's going to come down to, you know, how big this deficit ends up being that we have to fill. You know, whenever the legislature needs to find more money, this is sort of a bottom line thing. They fight about it. So if the deficit ends up being significant, I think you can expect, a long standoff. I don't want to, who knows what's going to happen, but that's been my experience.
It's funny, we were talking about recreational marijuana in Delaware and New Jersey, and now we're talking about Pennsylvania. John, is there any, if I can put it, appetite for that in Harrisburg?
Marty, you can pick any issue that reflects progressive thinking and ask the question, and the answer is no.
Is no. Even though there could be real money there?
Even though there could be real money there. I mean, I think that the sports betting stuff and the new mini casinos were kind of pushed through to avoid having to deal with medical marijuana. Governor Wolf, who as a candidate in October said he didn't think the state was ready to, and he was not ready to promote or endorse legislation creating recreational legalizing. And then a few weeks after he won re-election, seemed to change his tune, saying, I think we need to look at it seriously. And when he's asked about that, when I asked him about that, he said, well, what happened is pretty simple. The other states around us, notably New York and New Jersey, are going that way, and I'm a realist and, don't want to keep my head in the sand. But that does not change the cultural makeup of the legislature, and then that cultural makeup is opposed to legalization, and they will win because they have the votes.
Katie, I'm going to squeeze one more question in here having to do with new voting machines. We did a couple of shows about voting, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country, and our machines in Pennsylvania don't have a paper trail. Are there efforts to try to update the machines?
Yes. So some machines in Pennsylvania do actually have a paper trail. There's, like, different models across the state. But that being said, Governor Wolf has basically given a mandate to all the counties who control this process to update their voting machines before the 2020 election, actually before the midterms in 2019. So, there are going to be updates to the voting machines. Some people are not happy about this. What are you going to do? And actually, sorry, I should say the primary elections. That's when they want to get them updated. There was a federal court decision. This was in relation to a lawsuit by Jill Stein, but in part of the settlement, Pennsylvania actually made an agreement to update all the machines. So we kind of have this on paper now that we have to do it.
Well, I guess stay tuned. Katie Meyer, John Baer, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Thanks very much. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Also be part of our Facebook group and get special content from the show. Those of us who work on it, type Radio Times into the search bar and you're in. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.